Bang and Dylan for inviting me. So I wasn't sure who I'd be speaking to, so I included some introductory material at the beginning. I hope I don't bore the experts or anything like that. So the purpose of this talk is to explain my work extending Costello's formalism for renormalization to manifolds with boundary. And I'll work only in the scalar field theory case for simplicity here. So let me begin by just recalling the traditional formulation of effective field theory. I'll denote the space of fields by script E, which will be smooth functions on a compact manifold. There'll be a differential operator, the Laplacian, and a collection of functionals. I won't be precise about where these live yet. Okay. Depending on an energy cutoff parameter, which is a positive real number, right? Then there's a compatibility condition, called the renormalization group equation, so I'll denote RGE, which says if you integrate out higher energy modes, you'll recover the lower energy cutoff action functional. Okay. So this functional will be, it'll be a polynomial functional. I won't be precise about exactly its form, but this phi will live in the span of the eigenvectors of D, whose eigenvalue is less than or equal to lambda. I'll denote that space by E sub 0, like this. So it'll live here, and I want to recover the higher energy, I want to recover the lower energy functional from the higher energy one. And I can do this by integrating out the intermediate modes. So if we assume that these functionals have a specific form, that they're some quadratic part plus an interaction, then I can equivalently write this just in terms of the interaction. I'm missing the H bars here. So this form plus Wick's theorem You'll use the fact that the eigenspaces are orthogonal. So the eigenspace of fields, low energy fields, so cutoff at lambda L, is orthogonal to this space. That will allow you to get to the point where this equals the functional integral of this. And then you can use Wick's theorem to express it as a contraction with the propagator. Okay. So this D says contract with the propagator, which is the inverse of D. On this space. Right. That's the traditional formulation, and we use the heuristic now that the length should go like 1 over the energy. So we want to reformulate this in terms of a collection of functionals. I, depending on L. So L is now length scale, also in R plus. And rather than cut off the space of fields, we're just going to regularize the propagator. So the space of fields will stay the same, and the propagator will be regularized using the heat kernel. Okay. So I get the Green's function if epsilon is 0 and L is infinity, at least on a compact manifold. That's true always. So we can regularize the propagator this way and state the renormalization group equation using the regularized propagator. I think this form appears first in Costello's book, essentially. And the reason given, well, one motivation for doing this is it's you can make it compatible with the BV formalism. There'll be a regularized BV operator you can define in this setting. Right. So the question then is, how do you construct such a collection of functionals? And the naive thing you can do is take the log of both sides here. So IL H bar log of this. Okay. And I'll just define this to be W. And just let epsilon go to 0. Okay, so I'll make this definition. Which is naive because this limit doesn't exist in most cases. The one case which is notable where it does exist is Chern-Simons theory, essentially due to the work of Axelrod and Singer. But then the question is, if it doesn't exist, such as in the case of a scalar field theory, how do you correct the situation? And one way of doing that is to subtract off another functional. So I'm starting with a classical functional. I don't have this yet, right? But I want to define this from a classical functional. And one way naively of doing that is to try to take this limit. And I said this limit will actually exist in some nice cases like Chern-Simons theory. Essentially, that was proved by Axelrod and Singer, although they didn't use this language, but for non-topological theories like that, you probably won't expect this limit to exist. And one way of correcting the situation is to construct counterterms and then subtract that from I. Okay. And Costello gives a procedure for doing that in this setting. So I said I wasn't going to be precise about the form of these functionals, but let me now be precise. So I assume that the functionals are of the form sum over I sub I comma k bar to the I. And this is just a formal sum in both indices, and I sub k is a polynomial functional of degree k on E. And if there's no h-bar dependence, these should be non-negative. There's no h-star dependence. We say I is classical. Okay. You're starting from a classical functional, and you want to construct I of L, which is of this form. Okay. And there is a combinatorial expression for W in terms of Feynman diagrams. So I look at the connected stable graphs, and I'm summing 1 over the number of automorphisms times a weight. Okay, so gamma should be connected stable. So what I mean by a stable graph it's a collection of tails, edges, internal edges, vertices, and there's also a genus function on the vertices associating a non-negative integer to each vertex. And then here, I raise h bar to the power of the genus, where the genus of gamma is the number of independent loops of gamma plus the sum of the genera of each vertex. Right, and by the stable condition, it's just a condition on the valency of the vertices of genus 0 and 1. So if you have a genus 0 vertex, that has to be at least trivalent. If you have a genus 1 vertex, that has to be at least univalent. And this sum will be well-defined if you restrict to just such things. There'll be a finite number of isomorphism classes of connected stable graphs. Okay. All right, so you have such a thing, and you want to, you have such an expression for W, and you want to formulate an inductive procedure for constructing ICT. Okay. So that will happen at the level of W gamma, which I haven't defined yet, but you can expect it'll just be formed by placing the propagators on the edges, the input fields on the tails, and the interactions on the vertices, and then contracting. Okay, so throughout, I'll just work in the specific case of this graph in the Phi 4 theory. So we're going to work in the Phi 4 theory. With this graph. Okay. And I'll show you how to construct the counterterms for this graph, both in the case of Rn and the half space. And then I'll say how you can, how it works in more generality for manifolds with boundary, as well as closed manifolds. Okay. So what is the weight for this graph? All right, so I'm assuming we're in the situation where we don't have anything here yet. We're just starting with this, and we're seeing just trees first, and there's no need to construct this yet because the limit will exist for those. And now we've come to one loop graphs, and we're trying now to make the limit exist by subtracting something off. Right, so this, remember the propagators of this form. So I'm going to bring the integration over the time variables outside. Okay, so I brought the integration outside, and there'll be something else, which is an integration over m squared for each of these vertices, and I'll call that f sub gamma t1 t2 of phi. And that will be of the form Okay. So I'm going to call this capital phi. And I'm going to use the form of the heat kernel on Rn now. Let's just work on Rn first. So this will be four pi t to the minus n over two, e to the minus x, norm x1 minus x2 squared over four t. Right? So I'm not going to write any of the constants. I'll just call them all C. They're product C. So you'll have something like this. Then on the inside, you'll have an exponential. Calling that capital phi. And the idea is to make a change of variables and then Taylor expand this part. Right, so let W equal x1 plus x2 and y x1 minus x2. And I'm going to Taylor expand capital phi in y around y equals 0. So what you're going to be left with is a new constant. Right, so I'm going to define a new thing, which I'll call f upper n. And I'm going to place this phi upper n in place of phi. So this is now a polynomial in Y with coefficients and functions of W. And those functions of W are differential operators acting on the input fields. Okay, so you can apply, this is a Gaussian, sorry, this is a Y, I apologize. So this is a Gaussian integral in the y variable. So you can use Wick's theorem to compute that. And what you're going to get is a product, you're going to get rational functions, it's the square root of rational functions, sums of such things in t1 and t2, times a local functional of phi. That will be the form you're going to get. after calculating this Gaussian integral. And the idea is if you raise n to a high enough power, you should have enough control over the error of the difference of these two so that the limit exists. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
In this case, though, here, these differential operators have a bunch of deltas that have to go.
It depends on the order you expand. X. Okay, so I can change variables here and then take the derivative in y. So I'm going to get some differential operator. And then I set y equal to 0. Yes. So now I'm going to get that last integral over w will be a local functional. Okay. So can we control the error here? And to do this, Costello introduces a partition of the time domain e to epsilon to L to the number of edges. Okay. So in this simple case, we're going to have, first of all, I can assume this without loss of generality. So for every permutation of the I assign some ordering to the edges, and for every permutation, I'm in a different case. But let's just work with this. And then I also want to assume that I have some r, which we'll see later needs to be greater than 2, so that either this is true or this is true. Okay, so these are two cases we'll have to treat separately. And doing this will allow us to bound this error. So each of these cases will have a slightly different situation. Now this case here will apply to what we've done already. I'll have to do something new for this case. You can think of this as already taking an inductive step in some sense. All right, so we're just going to use this case for what we've done here. Okay. This you can think of as the base, this is like the inductive. This is the essence of the inductive procedure, this case. Okay, so I have this Gaussian integral. Now I have T2 greater than or equal to T1. So what I want to say just get 1 over 2t2 here. And then dn plus 1, y to the n plus 1. Okay, so I can put t2 here, and this thing will be less than or equal to this for that reason, because I have this. And then using this inequality, I can make this less than or equal to this. Because t2 has to be less than or equal to 1 for this to be possible. So T1 So 1 over T1 is less than or equal to 1 over T2 to the R. So I can bound 1 over T1 by 1 over T2 to the R. And then this will be less than or equal to this to the power R. Okay. So this is what I have. And then I can bound this then by power of T2. So I make a change of variables. I let y prime equal y over square root of t2. And then I pick up 1/2 n plus 1 plus n over 2. Okay, this factor comes from here, and this factor comes from the Jacobian. This is my total power of t now, p2, bounding this error. And the point is, I can make n large enough such that this whole thing is greater than or equal to 0. So that's this case, and then we need to treat this case. All right, and this case is done by, you can think of it as taking a subgraph. So this T1 corresponds to one of the edges. So I choose that. Any vertices connected to it? Okay. So I have this subgraph. So I'm going to try to separate out the part of this exponential corresponding to the subgraph from the rest of the exponential. That rest of the exponential will go with capital phi and be Taylor expanded. Okay. So I'm just going to use a different notation for the same f sub gamma. But I'll just, so this subgraph I'll call b prime. So let's use this notation now. Just to indicate we're going to do something different next. So this is what we had before. Okay. And I want to separate out what I said I did. And I'm going to call all this psi. And it's going to depend on y now. Sorry, it's going to depend on x2. Excuse me. I want to start from the point where I've already made the change of variables. So we have the time variables corresponding to this subgraph. I apologize for became confused temporarily. We have the time variables corresponding to the edges in the subgraph. So T1 wants to be separated from the rest of this. That's all I'm doing.
Okay.
I have something here, which is going to depend on y also now. And w. Okay. So this is going to be e to the minus norm of y squared over 4t2 times b. And we're going to Taylor expand this. This just depends on t2. We're going to Taylor expand this at y equals 0. It's inconvenient now. I have to go there. Every time I take a derivative of that, I could bring down a t2, a 1 over t2. I'm doing product rule. If the derivative hits the exponential, I could bring down a 1 over t2 at worst. Okay, so I'm going to do the same thing as I did before. I'm going to define f upper n as just the same thing, but placing the nth Taylor polynomial of psi now in place of psi. And I can control the error similarly. Right, so I can at worst bring down, right, so when using Taylor's theorem, when I'm doing this bound, I could at worst bring down a t2 to the minus n plus 1. That's the only difference. And now, what corresponds to, you know, the Gaussian integral will only depend on T1 because I'm only separating out that part. Okay. So this is equal to T2 to the minus n over 2 minus n plus 1 times T2 to the r over 2 times n plus 1. Okay. And the point is, if I make r greater than or equal to 2, I can make n sufficiently large that this is greater than or equal to 0. Okay, so this whole thing is T2 n plus 1 times r over 2 plus 1 minus n over 2. Okay, so if r is greater than 2, then for n sufficiently large, this can be made non-negative. Okay. So this might just be n, hold on. Yeah, that's correct, I think. So this cancels with the T1 here. So you're just left with T2 to the minus n over 2, plus what comes from this. Then I use the condition that T1 is less than or equal to T2 to the r here. Okay, assuming that, then I just collect everything, impose this condition, and I can make n sufficiently large. Right. How am I doing with time? So I'll now say what the difficulties are if Rn is replaced with Euclidean half space and also compact manifolds without boundary and with boundary. So Euclidean half space. Again, I have a heat kernel now. So this is Dirichlet. Right. So, okay. So, what I'm going to do is I can just let L equal to 1 for the sake of subtracting something off. So, if I integrate this from over this domain,
yep,
I'm getting a function of epsilon. That's going to be the term in I sub CT corresponding to this W gamma. Yeah. Yeah, so that will be one term here that we get from this graph. Right. I'm going to take this and integrate. And yeah, for sufficiently large n, I'm going to integrate it over the part of this domain that's cut out by these two boundary conditions, by these two conditions, these two inequalities. I'm going to integrate that, this over that, and I'm going to integrate this over the other part of the domain. Okay? And the sum of those two integrals will be the part of ICT corresponding to that, that graph. Yes. Yes.
Each graph might end up choosing two numbers, or maybe in general, there'll be more numbers
yeah.
if the graph is bigger.
Yeah.
And then, presumably, the bounds you've got, you can say, but these are what you need to ensure that.
Right, because if I integrate this side too from epsilon to one, right. Okay, so in the half space case, there is a Dirichlet-Lehy kernel where this is the reflection through the boundary. And I'm going to form the weight the same way, just instead substituting the Dirichlet-Lehy kernel. And there'll be some subtlety, though, because you're not going to get a non-degenerate quadratic form in the exponent. Excuse me. So I'm still going to have, so my sub gamma how should I say? Okay. And, okay, so for each one of these is going to have a difference of exponentials. So when I multiply them, I'm going to have four different terms, depending on which of these two I pick up from each factor of k here. All right, so since I'm running out of time, let me just talk about the part of this that's an integral over the direction normal to the boundary. Okay, so it in particular, it's going to have an exponential in it of this form. Okay, so let me call this y bar and this yn, this last, I'll keep calling that yn. So if I'm just restricting to the integration over the directions normal to the boundary, the exponential in that integrand will look like this. There'll be four terms in it. The sum of four exponentials. So there'll be one if I pick up this exponential each time. There'll be one if I say I pick up first one. And so forth. So there's one, there's two more. Yeah, so, right. Yeah, I just used X and Y. Yeah. Okay, so if I'm just looking at the direction normal to the boundary, it's going to be a sum of, at least the exponential part is going to be a sum of four terms, depending on which ones I pick up. Okay, and the issue is, it's not going to be non-degenerate, the quadratic form, after I make, so I made the change of variables there and I got something that was non-degenerate on our end. But it's not going to be now. So, luckily though, you can make, which I realized you can make a special change of variables. So if you look at this corner, which I'm getting from just the product of the directions normal to the boundary, I can look at this vector 1, 1, and then the plane perpendicular to it. And that will be my coordinate system. Okay, so so x1n, so u will be how far out along this vector I go, and then z will be how I go orthogonal to it. So I can make this change of coordinate. And so the integral over r plus squared now becomes an integral over 0 to infinity. That's the u integration, and then minus u to u. And problem then goes away because this integration is finite. So we're going to only Taylor expand. So this is the integration. This is the integration in U. This is the integration in Z. So when we write phi in terms of U and Z, I'm going to Taylor expand in Z, it's going to give me phi. And then I'm going to have these Gaussian integrals with degenerate exponents, and sorry, just exponential integrals now with degenerate exponents. And this is still going to make sense because this is over a finite domain. Okay. And in fact, for this term, you get the same bound on the error. And for these terms, you actually get a slight improvement by a power of 1/2 as just a slightly better bound. Okay. I will just say briefly about the other two cases, which build on these. So for a closed manifold, M, we can take the asymptotic expansion of the heat kernel. And I can take this asymptotic series to some order n prime and replace kT with that. And this is uniform asymptotics here. So, and I'm missing something, sorry. This is uniform, so when I'm integrating, the error bounds will work. So what you do is you take a partition of unity, and now you're just integrating in some collection of charts on M. I make this replacement. So I'm essentially in this situation. And the only issue is this is the geodesic distance, not the Euclidean distance. Right, yeah. So you can, you just assume it's the Euclidean distance, then you can just apply that directly. But I worked on that for a while, and I think it is asymptotic, but point-wise, in the if you just replace this with the Euclidean distance. But you really need the uniform to make those bounds work. So you can't quite do that. But what I did was I took a spanning tree, and you can just drop all the terms in the exponent whose edges don't come from edges in the spanning tree. And then in that spanning tree, you can actually make, if you just have terms coming from edges in the spanning tree, you can actually make the replacement of the. So you take a spanning tree, and there's a unique path between any two vertices. So what you do is you choose a starting vertex, and its neighbors, you take exponential coordinates to them. And then from those, you take exponential coordinates to the next nearest. Yeah. And doing that, you can just drop all the terms. When you're doing this bound, you can just drop all the terms not coming from the edges in the spanning tree, and then you can bound the error as well. Okay, and then case of compact manifold with boundary. I had some difficulty with this in full generality because I don't think there's a rigorous derivation in the literature of this asymptotic expansion in this case. There's paper by physicists. Yeah, so if you can double, if you put an additional structure on the boundary, which I did, if you assume there's a neighborhood of the boundary which is isometric to a product, then you can certainly double and then and do this. That's what I did. If you don't have such a structure, I think if the boundary is totally geodesic, you can double, but the heat kernel, so if you can, if the boundary is totally geodesic, you can still double, but the metric may not be smooth. So you can double as a smooth manifold, but the metric may not be smooth. And then I don't think you can construct this because these AIs will involve arbitrary large powers, derivatives of the metric. So I don't think you can do it even in that case. Although there were some physicists who I won't mention who claimed they could do it in the 90s. As far as I can tell, there's no rigorous derivation of this in this case. So I just restrict it to the case where the boundary has a neighborhood. Such that this neighborhood is isometric to EM cross. And then in the normal direction to the boundary, I just applied the same analysis I did to the normal direction here. And in the tangential direction, I applied this analysis. And together, I was able to work out that case as well. Two other things I did was, I sort of refined. So in general, for a general Feynman graph, you'll have this to the number of edges. And I sort of refined, it was already implicit in Costello's book, but I refined the covering lightly. So in his book, he has these things called A, which are cut out by these inequalities. So, and to prove that these subsets A cover the entire domain, he actually sort of constructs a more refined cover. I just made that explicit in my paper. And the second thing was I generalized the Wicks theorem in order to calculate the counter terms in these other two cases. Such as gauge theories? I don't see any. I mean, I haven't thought about whether when you construct this, I mean, I don't think it would be a problem. I haven't considered the Neumann case because my interest was in gluing. So I was following that paper, just trying to do the Dirichlet case. So I will add, I'm trying to add in boundary fields right now. So This is essentially just if we forget about the boundary fields. Right.
In practice, though, these Dirichlet boundary conditions are kind of implemented, or the Neumann are implemented by Dirichlet and anti fields, right?
No, that was the kind of special thing that these topological theories were.
Yes, sure. I don't mean it absolutely, but like in a lot of examples of interest.
I think like using the first rule of formulas and the normal derivative.
Okay.
You thought about, so ultimately, like, a more big picture goal for perspective, you would like to be able to define quantum observables on a manifold with boundary, or maybe on some open sets of boundary. And the early book for doing that involves sort of first finding global quantum observables, subsets, or something. Of course, the connection between the books here and everything is not spelled out in the second super explicitly. I would say, like, going all the way back to Venn diagrams, that sort of thing. Their third book?
Volume 2, what was that called?
Volume 2. Yeah, I see. The second one. Yeah. No, but I mentioned that. I was thinking of your book, the Open Sets.
What do you think? If you think of interactive, it would be better.
Yeah. I guess it's not.
You don't have to say that.
Yeah, it's sort of. Yeah, you don't end up discussing, you sort of say, like, for these parts, you should refer back to, like, you're not sort of saying, like, here we use proposition blah. And blah. Okay. Yeah, it's there, definitely. Say what you're supposed to do. But have you thought about, ultimately, along lines of what I was just getting at now, if we'd like to find quantum observables on this. Really, this is going to have to do with finding the class here and on some complex of
altogether as a whole. At least by each one.
Through everything right now, but it would be nice to be able to say that essentially your work implies a punchline theorem that you actually construct this quantum observable complex as they do on a manifold boundary.
Okay.
At least globally, or in some examples, say, like, for things that fit within this constraints of Dirichlet.
Okay.
But you could do that.
Yeah, the types of examples that we are able to. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Perfect. Classic. Presumably, having actually the global site